It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we are with the Titanic Tuesday edition of The Horn for this, the 26th day of September, 2017. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live on the Internet. That's where you go if you'd like to jump into the chat room. Folks already meandering by for this Titanic Tuesday. If you pick out a free screen name and a free password and hop in, you'll be met by Anatole and Jugapunch and Silent R. Lamar and... Longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who being a he was promoted, remember, to a spacing guild master. That was back when he folded space three ways. He's folded space to become man cave in the comfy confines of his Northern California man cave. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is the last broadcast week of September 2017. Soon we will be in our anniversary month, and I'll be away, program note. I'll be away for the first week of our anniversary month. I'm off to D.C. next week to work on the AIC campaign and do some work related to the Stalinist suppression of science that the Kaiser Kumquat administration has been engaging in. So that means we'll be a week behind in fundraising by the time I get back if we don't catch up on the front end this week. Okie doke. So what does that mean? Well, fundraising wise, we find ourselves down $388.70. It would actually be more. It would be 218. It would be 418.70 were it not for our subscribers. Thank you very kindly to Karen in Colorado, and thank you to Melton in California, and thanks as well to Michael in Madison. That's a big difference. The difference between $218.70 and $188.70 for a total fundraising goal this evening of $388.70. And great God Almighty, I can hardly, if we were actually trying to do 2 weeks at once so that we're not in a great big gigantic hole, we would be somewhere around, oh Jesus. Let's see, 183, it's a cipher and carry the phone pole. I'd be 788.70, pretty sure, but I think that's probably a lost cause. So if we can just raise, 388.70 this evening, that would be huge. So that we're not in a giant hole as we, because Friday will be the last day of September, and so everything, licking the Lithuanian and nudging the Norsky and cashing the check all hinge upon us getting to Friday without being in a giant screaming hole. If you want to help out,
If you've never heard this before, then you probably nobody gets charged here. This is all free. Except, of course, if you want to spend $29.95 for a month's supply of bananas. Bananas for when your world has gone bananas and you want to go with it. Bananas from Horn Labs, a proprietary blend of only the finest organic non-GMO bananas reduced to capsule form, which you can take to get your daily dosage of banana goodness. You know, I've never been a big fan of bananas, never been able to really eat bananas, and to this day, the only way I can get my nutritional intake of banana wonderfulness is with bananas from Horn Labs. Bananas, remember, go bananas with bananas, or get bananas now because you were already bananas. Bananas from Horn Labs. Only $29.95 for a one-month supply. And if you act now, and operators are standing by, well, then for only $60, only 10 cents more, we'll provide you with a two-month supply of bananas from Horn Labs. If you're going to go bananas, go the Horn Labs way with bananas. Okay? Okay. So, since that's not really for sale, since that's just a giant mockery of all the bullshit that gets hustled, you know, beets and whatever out there otherwise, we don't sell anything here. So what we have is a community effort. What we have is a community effort to keep this all going. When you contribute to the Horn, you make the Horn available for those who can't, who can't support it financially. So that's how it all works. We're still looking for 400 people at $10 a piece to cover the monthly bills, so I don't have to talk about this foolishness anymore. It's not foolishness. It's this annoying business of fundraising. We still have a long way to go. There's two ways to do it. You go to headonradionetwork.com. You click on contribute. You click the little box that says make this a recurring monthly donation. You put in the $10. Mr. Clooney, Mr. DiCaprio, Mr. Soros, Ms. Streisand, Ms. Winfrey. Y'all just type the number 1 and start hitting that 0 button till your little old finger gets tired, okay? But everybody else, just put in it. Or if you want to help out at some other number, just put that in. Don't check the box. And if you don't like PayPal, there's always Patreon. Patreon.com, patreon.com/Bob Kincaid. And there's a subscription campaign going on over there. And there are, I'm steadily sending out bumper stickers for everybody who does become a subscriber. I've gotten some emails back. Folks really like them. And I hope you like yours as well. So it's about 8 minutes past the hour. It is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. That's the day when we celebrate titanic exercises of right-wing intellect on this program. It all goes back many years ago to right-wing radio in Beckley, West Virginia, America's fifth smallest radio market, when the morning monotone, the morning right-wing monotone, took a break from reading the newspaper to everybody and making them drive into telephone poles once the narcolepsy kicked in. And to take a call from one of his right-wing, mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing followers, who said, "Steve, how come you reckon it is that they are seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? I done been in the mines many a time, and I've seen ferns and tree trunks and some seashells. I even seen some seashells down by the ancient seashore. And why is they there, Steve?" To which the morning monotone replied, "Well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates." He was a real broadcast talent, Steve was, from a monotone standpoint. So we celebrate Titanic intellect every Tuesday, and we've got plenty of it later in the program. Those Titanic plates are always shifting around all the time. No word yet on movement of the Titanic ceramic pizza stone. No word at all. So That's why Titanic Tuesday. But I'm going to interrupt the ordinary progress of Titanic Tuesday because I have a friend and a guest on the phone at the moment who has graciously agreed to come on and talk a little bit about his experiences, what with the Ken Burns Vietnam War documentary being out. Ed Rabel, y'all know him. Ed Rabel is an Emmy Award-winning journalist. And among the other places around this busy, violent, often blood-soaked globe that he has covered and visited, one of those places was Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And there are a lot of journalists who are clips of journalists that are shown in the Vietnam War documentary. And I thought, who better to talk to than my buddy Ed Rabel about that documentary and about his experience versus what is being portrayed in that documentary. So let's run over there post haste. Hey, Ed, I'm so glad you could join us this evening.
Bob, thank you very much for having me on.
It's a real pleasure, and I guess you heard what I was saying there. Let me just start you. You've got real live on the ground correspondent experience with the Vietnam War. When were you there,
Bob? I was there. Pardon me. three different times. First time for 13 months covering combat operations from the end of 1971 to the beginning of 1973, all over South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Then I went back again in 1973 for the so-called Easter Offensive, when the North Vietnamese almost did what they did in 1975, which was to overwhelm the South Vietnamese military. And, of course, the entire country of Vietnam became communist in 75. And then I went back again, pardon me, in 25 years after the Tet Offensive to take a look at how Vietnam had fared under the communists. So I have quite an experience with Vietnam.
Without a doubt, and like I said, that's why I'm so pleased to be having this conversation. Let me ask you the necessary second question. Then, have you been watching? Have you watched the Burns documentary?
Gosh, I've seen every one of the segments, and I've watched a couple of them twice, and I'm just fascinated by it. I think they have done a terrific job in telling the story, and of course. One of the reasons for my saying that is I have learned quite a few things that I had no idea had occurred even while I was there and prior to my being there and of course, what has happened since that time.
So with you having first gone in 1971, the Johnson ramp up and everything. Your experience with Vietnam was, shall we say, Nixon's Vietnam.
You're absolutely right. Here's the thing. Pardon me. Nixon did not want to be the first American president to lose a war. And I guess Johnson didn't either. And the way Johnson got out of it was by basically saying he wasn't going to run again for president. And then Nixon came in and basically lied and extended the war. You know, the peace talks were about to happen, and Nixon got in touch with Tu, the leader of South Vietnam, our puppet there, and he was able to convince Tu not to go to the peace talks in Paris, and therefore he extended the war. So, you know, Nixon basically was responsible for the deaths of about 20,000 more GIs in Vietnam because of the extension of the war. What I did was cover what we called the so-called Vietnamization of the war, which was the turning over to the South Vietnamese military and the South Vietnamese government the war which we, the United States, have been waging for a very long time. So, that was ultimately a failure because United States troops were being withdrawn while we turned the war over to the Sudanese, and because most of those most of the soldiers in the South Vietnamese army were unwilling to fight for that corrupt government that we were supporting in South Vietnam. And, of course, that has a lot of that echoes what is going on these days in Afghanistan and Iraq. I see parallels there quite vividly.
Well, I've made the observation previously, Ed, that one of the things that, and I can't help it, I watch these things with a critical eye. I'm not watching it looking to say somebody was wrong or somebody was right. But I watch it trying to, just because I feel like it's my job to see or to try to perceive when my opinion is, when someone is trying to manipulate my opinion.
Right.
And
yes.
So I do see some of that going on. What I've pointed out to the Horn Family Community Congregation over the course of the last week or so, that one of the more jarring examples is the fact that when it comes to describing, for instance, the North Vietnamese retreat from Hue, and they talk about the killings of all of the collaborators and the South Vietnamese government officials, you know, murders, okay? A slaughter. It was a slaughter. Burns has no problem in his script referring to that as a massacre. But when it comes time to talk about My Lai, they're killings. They're not murders.
Yeah.
It's not a massacre.
You're right about that.
And I personally don't appreciate, you know, you worked in journalism, you know, language matters. How you describe something affects the perception of it. And so I guess the question that with all of this is prologue, Ed, the question that I lead into then with you is, does it bother you at all when you see this, when you see the opening credits, to see David H. Koch splashed across the screen there all by himself as one of the primary funders of the vehicle?
Clearly that was jarring to me when I saw that, and the implications are quite obvious. I just wonder whether... because of the value of this entire series, this, I guess it's a 10-part series by Ken Burns, and that they were able to do it and had enough money to do it, whether we can give Koch a pass on that. But I'm not sure. I don't know. I do know that last night, for example, Ken Burns' series does talk very dramatically about the killing by the Tiger Force in 1967 of unarmed civilians.
He does
rapes
that.
Rapes and torture. Yeah. And so, I think that United States does not necessarily come off very well in... I think he's been rather candid in much of what he has portrayed.
And he makes what appears to be a point of offering up a pox on both their houses when he says five presidents got mired in it, five presidents made mistakes, Democrats and Republicans alike. That and there's an undeniable element of truth to that, Ed. But by the same token, I also can't help viewing all of this in the wider context of the world in which we presently live. And that sounds a lot like something that we've identified on a number of occasions in the wider for-profit media that is called both-siderism. In other words, we can't say that, you know, well, it's like Charlottesville, okay? That if you condemn the Nazis... They went, well, you know, but, you know, there were some mean Antifa people there, too.
And that's right. I used to have this debate with the producers at CBS and NBC. Not really a debate. They tended to agree that, for example, about portraying both sides of an issue or both sides of the story, sometimes there is no other side. I mean, Hitler You know, he was a bad guy, and there's no two ways about it. And don't try to tell me that just because he made the trains run on time, that there were two sides of the story. It's just not true. And so I have that same problem as you do.
And then as in terms of a final just observation from my part, I'm worried, and you know very well, you're a student of history, as am I. You know what I'm talking about when I describe the lost cause as it was developed and promulgated and promoted in the generation following the Civil War. The lost cause
right.
is part of the problem that we have to this day.
Absolutely. Correct.
And a generation or two on from Vietnam, this, and tell me if you think there's a danger here. It feels like there's almost a little bit, because, you know, again, Burns rises to prominence on his Civil War documentary, and there was a lot of lost causism in that, too. And it almost feels
yeah.
like he's trying to create a lost cause mentality to Vietnam, and that scares the hell out of me, Ed, because it makes me worry that we're gonna get people thinking, well, you know, it's not that we didn't have any business there. It's just that we didn't do it right. So someday, next time we need to invade a foreign country, we'll get it right this time. And we've already seen that in Afghanistan and Iraq, have we not?
We have. You know, the thing that is troubling to me about these lost causes is that many of those people who subscribe to the lost cause are actually in power now. I mean, I think, Bob, that we are suffering from what I like to call the tyranny of the minority. I mean, we need checks on the tyranny of the majority, certainly. But what we have now is the tyranny of the minority, and that is conservatives who still subscribe to white supremacists' ideas and concepts are actually making a policy or are directing things. And that is really scary. I'm wondering about where all this ends. But, you know, Trump's election has revealed many dark truths about this country. And one of them is that we're a lot less democratic than we might think.
And we are a lot less equality driven than we like to tell ourselves.
Right.
The recent business with the taking a knee during the anthem kind of puts paid to the idea of equality, because, you know, some people are more equal than others, and if you're standing for the national anthem, by God, you're equal. But if you're worried, and if you are disturbed, if you are horrified by the ongoing onslaught of violence against young black men in this country, well, then, you know, you're a malcontent, you're uppity, you don't love America. You are, in the words of Donald Trump, disrespecting the flag and the country.
Yeah. Well, you know as well as I do that basically what that is racism. I mean, the demographics point, and all these guys who are saying that you must stand for the national anthem and that there's no, that this whole business of the Black Lives Matter and all that, you know as well as I do that what they see is coming is that old white guys like me are going to be in the minority pretty soon, not too long in the future, and they're holding on by the skin of their teeth. And so this is what that's all about. It has to do with racism and bigotry. It's as simple as that, in my view.
And so if that is the resurgent attitude in this country, and I think we are in a state of agreement that it is, does that not give you pause to fear that, because, you know, racism is boundary transcendent. Racism is something
right.
that can happen internal or external. And when we talk about the Vietnam War documentary and the Vietnam War itself, were there not, I mean, it strikes me that there was a hell of a load of racism that went into the calculus that decided to go there in the first place.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, look at all of those white kids from very well-to-do, not even necessarily so well-to-do, families could get their kids either to Canada or in college and get a deferment for one reason or the other. And what we wound up with was young black men, young poor whites, poor Hispanics, the minorities fighting our wars for us. Now, today, I mean, they got smart, the military did, the government, and so they got rid of the draft and introduced the all-volunteer force. But even with that, because poor people have to join up in order to survive because they don't have the jobs that are out that were promised to them, and still we have poor whites and blacks fighting our wars for us. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, it's clear someone once said, I'm sick and tired of old men dreaming up wars for young men to fight in. And we still have that problem today.
I think you're absolutely right. And it scares me because I think, even on the policy level, there was a decision there was a decision made that somehow or another, after fighting off foreign incursion, foreign invasion, colonialism for 1,000 years, because remember that was right. One of those things that that was said during the Vietnam era, them people have been fighting each other for 1,000 years. you heard it. I know you heard it as an excuse
sure.
for, they'd be fighting us. They'll fight anybody. And that's a dehumanizing, othering kind of an attitude. So it was that colonialist, racist attitude that led us into there in the first place, was it not?
I agree with you. I don't know whether you've seen the hour-long documentary that was produced by West Virginia Public Television on five West Virginia Vietnam veterans who told their stories about their participation in the Vietnam War. And who were they? They were, not so young, he's old like I am now, black guy, and another guy who lost both of his legs. They've gone through hell, not only in Vietnam, but also in the post-Vietnam era. But they seem to be doing fairly well now. But that brings us to the whole question of how we treat these people we send off to the war once they're finished with it and once we're finished with them.
And that in the recent past, that has become the answer has become not so well. Well, with all the experience that you had there, and the fact that you continued, that was not the end of your journalism career by any stretch of the imagination. You did go all over the world. As you look at the world today, can you offer, and if you can't, you can't. Can you offer even a glimmer of hope that we're not going to get into another act of national bellicose stupidity here in the fairly near future? Because people are getting up every morning wondering, well, is this the day that we either nuke North Korea or we just get it, or we get into it with them one way or another? And it gets much less press, but there's saber rattling relative to Venezuela as well.
Oh, absolutely. Bob, here's the thing. Not to wax philosophical here, philosophically.
Oh, wax away, Ed. Wax away. We're just friends.
But what we have done as human beings, if we want to call ourselves that, we failed to bridge what is called the cultural gap. That is that we have advanced technology beyond our control. And we haven't advanced our ability as people, as Homo sapien, if you will, to catch up with it. And so consequently, because of that gap, we are liable to destroy ourselves. The thing about what you're talking about is that in the past, these have been conventional wars that we have fought with conventional arms. There's only been, obviously, one time when nuclear weapons were used in a war, and that we used it and killed a bunch of hundreds of thousands of Japanese, of course, and brought an early end to that war. But the problem here is that we have a whole bunch of nations, nation states, and nation states which, I mean, including North Korea, either who have the bomb or are trying to get it, and we don't have the means from a, I guess, brain power point of view to control it. There is every likelihood that if these things are used now, it won't be as it was when we fought conventional wars, where one side would be able to dominate the other with because of conventional, because we're just so powerful and so rich. The United States has been able to dominate in the past, but with nuclear weapons, if we unleash that could really mean the end of all humankind, and that's really what I worry about. People think, you know, oh, we'll survive a nuclear war, and people will survive, well, America will survive, and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's bullshit. I mean, excuse my friends.
No, you're just free to use that here.
Yeah. Well, I just think that we're kidding ourselves, and that not only are we kidding ourselves, but we'll be killing ourselves. So it's that's the problem. We're just not smart enough to be able to bring about a peace. Yeah, here's the thing. You know, I recently volunteered to become a Peace Corps volunteer in Uganda, and I'm going to go there for 2 years in November. And at the same time, I recall the time I served as a reporter in various wars, not only Vietnam, but in Central America and all around the world, in the Near East as well. And the thing about it is, the Peace Corps budget is about $418 million annually. Do you know what the DOD budget is for fighting wars and for also buying weapons to fight those wars? Why, my God, it's nearly $1 trillion annually. So you think about where our priorities are. You think about where we put our money, and you'll know where we come down on the question of trying to advance peace.
We spend a hell of a lot more money on war than we do on peace. I remember when Dennis Kucinich was roundly laughed at for saying, you know, we need a cabinet level department of peace. And it, you know, that didn't seem like such an outrageous idea to me, because, you know, I'm a leftist and that kind of thing, and I also am sort of pretty much anti-war unless somebody's shooting at me.
Right.
But we, you know, the State Department is it in many ways subservient to the Department of Defense, the Pentagon.
Correct.
And so consequently, we tend not to work toward peace as much as we do to make sure that we're fighting the wars we want to fight. And I don't think you're going to take terrible umbrage with me when I say that there is a madman in the White House, Ed.
Crazy man. I mean, an unhinged lunatic. That's the way I think of him.
I mean, never in the history of this country has there been anyone even vaguely resembling Donald Trump in the White House. And it strikes me that the entire machinery of the Constitution that was designed to keep people like him from happening or to remove him from office should that mistake be made, it's all failed, Ed. It's all failed. The constitutional crisis started on January 20th. So I get a little irked when I hear commentators say, "Well, you know, we could be on the cusp of a constitutional crisis there, Wolf." You know, God damn it, we're in one. And how do we respond when he finally does decide to start a war?
Let me tell you something. I know something about the one man's ability to start a nuclear war, and the president has that capacity, that ability in his hands. I don't care how many times people will say that, McMaster or Mattis or Kelly, who's the chief of staff, they'll prevent him from doing that. Well, they can't. The truth of it is, there would be a constitutional crisis if they. Well, it would be a coup d'état if the military were tried to do that, but that might be the only way to prevent him from embroiling us in a nuclear contest and perhaps in all of humankind. I don't know. That's a real constitutional problem. There's legislation that has been introduced to try to limit the president's power to wage war. But that has gone nowhere because, in part, because the Republicans won't have it. What I want to discuss is a structural problem that both underlies and transcends our current political nightmare. We have entered a period of minority rule. I don't just mean the fact that Trump became president despite his decisive loss in the popular vote, though that shouldn't be forgotten. Worse, the majority of voters who disapprove of Trump have little power to force Congress to curb him. The reason for that is a combination of gerrymandering and the tight clustering of Democrats in urban areas means that even if Democrats get significantly more overall votes than Republicans in the midterms, which polls show is probable, they may not take back the House of Representatives. According to a Brookings Institution analysis in 2016, Republicans won 55.2% of seats with just under 50% of votes cast for Congress. And because of the quirks of the 2018 Senate map, Democrats are extremely unlikely to reclaim that chamber, even if most voters would prefer Democratic control. So some analysts have even suggested that the Republicans could emerge from 2018 with a filibuster-proof 60-seat majority. What I'm saying here is that with this minority rule by people in flyover country, and I don't mean to denigrate them, I'm just saying it's a reality, and that with the problem with the way our system is set up in terms of nuclear strike, first strike capability, or a defense, basically, the first strike would come as a result of this problem that we have with who has control. Because decisions in a nuclear, if an adversary were to launch a nuclear strike, the president only has a few minutes to make up his mind about what to do. And he has the authority, even though Mattis, the defense secretary, has the capacity to not concur with the president. He still cannot stop the president from launching a nuclear strike. So it's a huge problem. And that, coupled with the fact that we have a real problem with minority rule, I think we're in far more serious trouble than most people in America understand.
Well, amen. So are there any remedies?
Well, our Constitution has always had a small state bias, but the effects have become more pronounced as the population discrepancy between the smaller states and the largest states has grown. So and that distortion carries over to the Electoral College as well. I don't know, aside from, introducing legislation or changing the Constitution, I'm not sure that we really, there's actually been, as you well know, talk of states like California's, much like the Confederate States of America, forming their own nation. And where a majority of voters and a supermajority of Californians are thwarted, polls are showing that a third of Californians favor secession. Could that fringe movement become mainstream? Well, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that the country could actually break apart, even if a lot of people don't think that's likely. I think it's a possibility.
Oh, I think it's a certainty within 100 years. Supposedly, supposedly in the aftermath of the Civil War, Ed, the Supreme Court dealt with the issue of secession and said, no, everybody's in it for good. Once you're in, you can't get out. But, but you know, any Supreme Court decision can be overruled as well if you get the right kind of personnel on the court. In the nearer term, Ed, I mean, I think about, okay, so let's time travel again. Before how long were you a journalist before you were sent to Vietnam?
Well, CBS hired me directly from West Virginia. I was news director at Channel 8 in Charleston in 1966. And so I went to Vietnam, and I was hired directly by CBS to become a CBS correspondent in 66. And then I went to Vietnam in 70. I volunteered to do that. One of the differences, by the way, Bob, between when I covered the war, when I went there, Military Assistance Command Vietnam, MACI, I checked when I got to Saigon, which is now Ho Chi Minh City. I got there, and they gave me the rank of major in the United States Army. I could go out to, and they gave me, fatigues and boots and stuff, and put my name on the uniform, and I was had the rank of major, and that meant I could go out to Tonsonet Air Force Base and get on any military helicopter or airplane and take my camera crew and go anywhere in the country and interview anybody I wanted to without any control or guidance or any minder to prevent me or thwart me from telling the truth. The Pentagon, just as with the draft, learned the lesson, and that is don't ever let reporters go out there on their own and cover the story because they might tell the truth. So what they've done is now if you are a reporter and you want to cover a war, as in the Iraq war, what they do, the military says, no, you can't have access to the battlefield on your own. You are going to be embedded with a unit, and being embedded means you are limited to what you can see and whom you can talk to and where you can go. And so that is another method for constraining or restraining the truth, and also making sure that the military's message gets out. Whereas when I was in Vietnam, the idea at the 5 o'clock follies where the military in the afternoon in Saigon would call reporters together and give them briefings, and it was always we are winning the war. There's light at the end of the tunnel. Now all that matters is body count. How many bodies, how many Vietnamese did we kill today? And that was the criteria. Those were the criteria on which the briefers, the military, said they were winning the war. Of course, they weren't winning the war because I'd go out in the field and there was a much different story out there. And most of the people I interviewed, most of the GIs I interviewed, most of the, even the officers in the field would tell me a much different story. Of course, you know, we got blamed for the loss of the war in Vietnam, which is utter nonsense. But nonetheless, we got blamed for it. But the truth is, one of the reasons we lost the war is because reporters were able to tell the truth about how our strategy was failing in Vietnam.
And very undemocratic, that, wouldn't you say? The idea
of...
Oh,
goodness, yeah.
Right. Well, the reason I asked you when you first started in journalism was...
Right.
You didn't just, sign on with CBS and get on a plane. You had substantial experience doing reportage before you ever went, by about 5 years. So you saw the anti-war effort or the anti-war protests, I presume.
Yes.
And so you know what the scene was like back here at home. How effective do you think that anti-war effort was?
Well, I thought it was pretty effective. I thought you remember part of the anti-war effort was based on truth-telling by reporters. And that is to say, a guy like Walter Cronkite went out there to Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, after the Tet Offensive of 1968, in which Vietnamese Viet Cong and North Vietnamese regulars rose up all over South Vietnam and attacked about 70 different hamlets and villages and towns and cities all over, after the United States had been telling the American people that that we were winning. So Cronkite saw all of that and saw that we were not winning, and he came back and said the United States, on the air, he said that the United States could not win in Vietnam. And Johnson, President Johnson, said to his advisors, if I have lost Walter Cronkite, I have lost Middle America. And he was right, and that's one of the reasons that he had decided not to run again. But having said that, the anti-war effort was terribly important to turning things around and causing Nixon to not end the war immediately, which he should have done, but causing him to develop a strategy in which he said that the United States was going to get out of Vietnam, quote, honorably, which it did not, and began withdrawing United States troops and trying indeed to end the war, but on his terms, so he didn't look like he was the first American president to lose the war. But nonetheless, what I'm saying, to make a long story short, is that that pressure brought about by what people saw on the television screens in the evening, and also because of the protests in the street, which, as you remember, were quite violent. Those things, I think, combined to help bring about an end to the war. But there's one other thing that I want to say at this juncture, and that is that I am so astonished with how grotesque, how vulgar the Republicans have become and have pandered to this these people who have come out of the woodwork and are marching the streets with swastikas and Confederate flags and all of that. The reason I'm so astonished by that is I thought we had, because of my remembering reporting on the civil rights movement in America and the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the election of Barack Obama as president, black man, I thought we had overcome, indeed, to a certain extent. I'll be damned if we haven't learned anything. I mean, we are really a smarmy bunch of, or not all of us, but there is about 30 or 35% of voters who are really not just in opposition, but they are grotesque in their opposition. They are vile. They remind me of pre-World War II Germany when the Nazis, the neo-fascists, rose up. I mean, it's just awful. It's absolutely something terribly embarrassing.
And it also proves, I think, Ed, that you know there's that old adage: one bad apple doesn't spoil the barrel. Yes, it does, because when one bad apple rots, the rot follows through everything else. It runs through everything else in the barrel. And no, 100% of America, 90%, 80%, 70% of America isn't, they're not what I call maggots. Make America great again, Trumpanzee scum. Maggots. But there are enough of them in this country to poison everything good about us. We are become a nasty place, a hateful place, and it's not. It's not because one quarterback took a knee in protest of police violence against people of color. It's because of the response to that, the fascist response. Fascism is on the march again. I asked you.
You got it.
I asked you in particular, Ed, about the anti-war effort. because one of the things that I've been raising over the past few weeks is, you know, I remember the protests, which can, and the anti-war efforts in advance of George W. Bush's decision to attack the innocent people of Iraq, and it manifested itself in at least a significant objection to that war, but it didn't stop it.
Right.
And I don't know how to say this because, well, I mean, I'm not trying to be offensive, is what I'm saying. Barack Obama tried to get out of Iraq, but some of the other stuff, some of the other militaristic things continued to go on, the drone strikes and things like Yemen and arms deals with the Saudis, whom I despise. And it kind of makes me wonder, is there an anti-war left in this country anymore? If Trump does something stupid, and if, as you have pointed out, and I think we can correctly assume, the compliant Republican Congress blithely goes along with it, can people in the streets even stop that anymore? Because, you know, the significant element of the Vietnam War protests had to do with the draft.
Right.
Well, there's no draft anymore. And nobody's got skin in the game except for the people who have skin in the game, namely the people
right.
who are actually associated with the military. And what, less than or around 1% of the American population has any connection to the military whatsoever. That's a number I read at one point. Yep. I don't doubt
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah,
so,
no, that's correct.
So if we march off, if he decides to start something, whether it be conventional or nuclear, and take with this also factor in the shattering of what used to be the so-called left, the centrist Democrats, progressives, liberals, what have you, a million tiny pieces. Who comes together to oppose all that under that circumstance, Ed?
Well, you know, we've talked about this earlier in this conversation, but, you know, one of the things that we should think about is that conservatives are often unmoved by complaints that our system is undemocratic, arguing that America was intended not as a democracy, but a republic. But if this was true at the founding, it's probably not how most Americans understand their country today when undemocratic is considered a political epithet. Now, before Trump, there was enough overlap between popular will and electoral outcome to make the issue largely semantic. Now, it's existential. Certainly, we need checks on the tyranny of the majority, but what we have now is the tyranny of the minority. There are ways out. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, for example, a plan in which states agree to award all their electoral votes to the national popular vote winner, could circumvent the Electoral College if enough states enacted it. But, you know,
and if upon the obligatory or certain to follow Supreme Court challenge, let such a law stand.
Sure. No, that's right. Well, anyway, we've got to figure out a way to transform the manner in which we choose our leaders. But doing that, as you point out, is really remote. But, you know, absent reform, our system, I think, could eventually face a legitimacy crisis. At some point, we need to discuss the extent to which the entire constitutional system is full of these anti-majoritarian aspects. So, that's rather broad and the only thing that I hope for, but it seems pretty remote to me.
Well,
I think to you as well.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I might be a little bit more grim and cynical than you are. I've I've declared a couple of times that we're circling the drain, or at least the idea of this country that was put forward, flawed though it was, because you have to say, you know, we're talking about a country that was, we're talking about a country, I mentioned this last night in discussing the anthem and all, white supremacism was the norm of this country.
Right, correct.
And so pointing out that someone, it was baked in. It was baked into the three-fifths compromise is white supremacy.
Correct.
So, you know, trying to get past that is what we've seen since the civil rights struggle. And that is a shorter span of time than the other span of time during which this country was deeply, broadly white supremacist. That's a problem. You say you just said, you know, you see us coming to a crisis of confidence, a crisis of legitimacy. I would say that the other part there, the other fork in the road, is that we just quietly continue down a road toward an imperial presidency.
Well, we will probably do that, but there's one other thing to keep in mind, and I know you haven't forgotten that, and that is that if we are able to endure and survive this maniac who is in the White House and this 35% who are now, you know, as I keep coming back to the tyranny of the minority, if we can make our way through it, there may be that the demographics will be such that within the next 20 or 30 years, most of the people who are just barely holding on are going to be dying off, and the minorities will be in the majority, and we will be able to turn this thing around. But that's the reason, Sessions and Trump want to rid America of those 800,000 dreamers, even though they contribute to society, and even though they're not gangsters, they're not criminals, they are good people. They want to get rid of them. They want to get rid of all the immigrants. They don't want to let anybody in, and the reason they don't want that is because they are fearful that they're going to once again be able to, from an electoral point of view, overcome this problem that we now have. And that's a real possibility unless this idiot builds the wall, which is symbolic, of course. You're not going to stop anybody from coming in with that wall. But nonetheless, this is what these vile people on the bottom who are in control now, that's what they're fighting for and hoping for. And I think that there's some truth in what you're saying, a lot of truth in the movement toward an imperial presidency.
Is there any way in the short term, because you and I are talking long term, is there any way in the short term to try, is there any unifying what I will refer to as the Democratic resistance to all of this coming up in 18 and 20? I mean, because I don't know what you see on social media, on your feeds, but I still see a whole lot of, if you mention Russian interference in the election, there's a whole bunch of people over on the so-called left who will holler, you know, Russia had nothing to do with it. Then they'll start shrieking about Debbie Wasserman Schultz or how corrupt Hillary was. And, you know, look, I supported Bernie Sanders in the primary here, and I voted for Hillary in the general election because Bernie Sanders didn't win, and I didn't want Trump. But there is a significant group of people on the so-called left who say, no, that wasn't good enough. And then you get the Susan Sarandon types who say that Trump will bring on the revolution. I don't see any signs of that revolution. And
no.
And what scares me to death is that we're going to keep picking at each other. The Hilarians will keep picking at the Bernie scabs, and the Burners will keep picking at the Hilarian scabs.
That's right.
And meanwhile, the common enemy of the common enemy of anybody who wants there to continue to be a United States is going to retain power in 2018, 2020. And here, let me just blow you away, Ed. We will have President Ivanka Trump on January 20th, 2025.
Not an unreasonable thought. I mean, not an unreasonable notion that that could happen. Yeah.
And by pointing it out, I'm not trying to pick anybody's scabs here. I want to figure out a way to go forward. I want to look primarily at stopping Trump, as opposed to imposing these unilateral purity tests on everybody who wants to run for office on the Democratic ticket.
Right.
But by the same token, I'm also a hypocrite, Ed, because Joe Manchin, there's the ultimate purity test, and you and I have both roundly criticized him for being a Republican in a Democrat's clothes for virtually all of his career.
Yes.
What do you do with something like that?
Well, I'm not in defense of Joe Manchin, but you think about it. I mean, he's in a state where 60% of those polled are pro-Trump. What if Joe Manchin suddenly were to become courageous and a candidate to be in John F. Kennedy's book Profiles in Courage? What happened to most of those guys who were in that book were defeated, and he would be defeated, and he knows it. So it has to do with the pragmatic politics. I suspect that he recognizes that there's no way to be a centrist or even right of center and win. You've got to be an extremist in this state.
And to be fair, it's not like Robert Byrd was a flaming liberal.
Yeah, that's right.
Nixon offered him a Supreme Court justiceship, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah, right. So, but remember, West Virginia was not always this rude, this red, but we have lost. Since I remember Jack Kennedy speaking on the steps of the State House in 1963 at the 100th anniversary of the statehood of West Virginia. And we were very, I think, a relatively liberal. The Union was very strong. Of course, Cole was king at the time. But since then, we've lost hundreds of thousands of the best and brightest in West Virginia. And we're left with about 1.8 million people in a state where there's no progressive thinking, where there's no looking forward. Emblematic of that is how here in the Kanawha Valley, time after time, the local power holders refused to build a new airport, which would be, if nothing else, symbolic of an advancement. But they want to stay in the past, and they want to maintain and control and protect their fiefdoms. And so as long as you have that thinking, as long as you have hundreds of thousands of West Virginians leaving, and this, by the way, is the state losing population faster than any other state in the Union. It is also number one in drug addiction. When you have that, if we're talking about the state of West Virginia and we're talking about how to get elected in this state against these forces of regression, it's very, very hard to enunciate or articulate even a center approach to trying to do something here in our state. And that's exactly why Ed Rabel couldn't win in our state. I got 6,200 votes in the second congressional district. And we now have a carpetbagger who represents us, who is absolutely has no knowledge of our state or of our district. And but nonetheless, people continue to vote for him, and they'll continue to vote for Shelley Moore Capito, and they'll probably reelect Joe Manchin.
Well, let me ask this: do you give any kind of chance at all to the alleged primary challenge to Joe Manchin?
No, I really don't. I think that's being hyped. I don't think anybody's going to really be able to challenge him very well. I don't.
No, it strikes me as more of a fundraising campaign than it is a political campaign.
Well, but, there you go. That's right.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Well, Ed, we have been all over the place. I asked you on to talk about Vietnam, and we did. But as I think Ken Burns' thesis is, he said he wanted to make the documentary because it touches so many other aspects of American life. And I think even without necessarily meaning to, I think we just proved his thesis.
Well, I think we did, and I think if they watch his series carefully, that the audience will realize that many of the things that he talks about in that series are exactly the kinds of things that you and I are talking about here tonight.
And so going forward, I imagine you're doing a lot of prep and a lot of packing. Can I just ask you, I've had you on the air for an hour, and you probably need to go, but what possessed you to do the Peace Corps?
Well, not to sound fatuous, and I really don't want to sound silly, but all my life I have, wanted to be of value and of service. I don't think any of us has any reason to exist if we aren't doing something meaningful and also doing something that advances who we are as human beings. So I wrote an op-ed piece in the Gazette, which talks to this question of why I did this back when I'm old enough to have remembered and watching John F. Kennedy tell us his inaugural that we ought to all of us think about what we can do for our country. And so I didn't just see that as theoretical. I saw it as something that I should act on. The first time I tried to act on it, I tried to become a Navy fighter pilot for the United States Navy. That didn't work out. Then I thought I'd become an attorney and represent the poor. That didn't work out. Then I became a broadcaster of news, and I saw that maybe if by telling the truth that I might be able to serve in some way. And then I realized lately, after running for Congress, trying to do great big things is not necessarily the approach. Bobby Kennedy said, if we just all of us do meaningful small things, that they all add up. And so I figured that by going off to Uganda and teaching kids English, that would be my small part. I finally realized that I could accomplish something by doing that. And so those are some of the reasons that I decided to do it.
That's magnificent. And will you be filing dispatches from there, or will you just sort of go off the radar?
I'll try to. I'll have a satellite telephone that I can use, and I'll use that, but I also will have some access to Wi-Fi out there. So from time to time, not as often. I won't belabor and bore everybody as much as I have been lately, but on Facebook, using the internet. But I'll have chances from time to time to file dispatches from there.
Well, Ed, if you and I do not speak again before you go, I wish you safe travels, and I have no doubt whatsoever that you will make a big difference in people's lives in doing what you're doing. And you have my thanks and my commendation.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me on.
It was an absolute pleasure. Take care, Ed, and thank you for coming on such short notice.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank
you. Take care. Bye now. Ed Rabel, Emmy Award-winning telejournalist with CBS and NBC, Vietnam War correspondent, activist, progressive, and pretty good guy. All around, good West Virginian. He's also somewhat practical in how he looks at this state, which you kind of have to be. I wish it was not I wish West Virginia was not what it is, but it is what it is. It's 9 minutes past the hour on this Titanic Tuesday, and we've got Titanic business to attend to in short order. We'll take a little break and sort of reboot, and I'll get my head out of that space and into a different space, preferably not in a bucket. And I will note that we began the program with a minimum of $378.70 to raise, and we're at zero. And it's just depressing as hell. I'll just say that. It's depressing as hell. But, you know, we'll as long as stuff stays on here, you know, once the power goes out and the internet goes off, this program's over. And I'm not saying that's happening tonight, but it could, you know, it could happen in relatively short order. The bills are paid on a monthly basis, and whatever. So that's kind of where we are. And going into prayer meeting Wednesday with a $578, or you know, maybe it'll be $558 or something like that. We don't have a lot of subscribers at this time of the month. It will be, you know, pretty stressful. But you know, we'll do what we can. So let's make the best of the rest of this week, and then hopefully, unless something changes, I'll be back for Friday on the front porch. We'll do a regular broadcast week this week, and then I'll try to be back for Friday on the front porch on Friday of next week. But no broadcast Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for sure, because I'm going to be working trying to raise people's awareness in another place where it matters very much, D.C., about the fact that everything's not okay here. And moreover, that not everybody is okay with what is being done here. Because what is being done here would be, you know, well, it would be a crime in other parts of this country. And in other parts of this world. So if at all possible we could take a bite out of that fundraising, it would be massively appreciated. Thank you very kindly, Glenn, for jumping in and getting started. Hopefully Glenn can get some company this evening. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you more than I can really express. Meanwhile, Don in West Tennistan, subject line, fuck! Ivanka, I just fell off my chair. Don't write it off. Like I've said before, that would be, you know, if he's still here, that would be the best finger in the eye that he could ever give to Hillary and all the people who said, you know, first woman president and all that. Yeah, okay, here's your first woman president, Ivanka. Ivanka says she's not interested, but that's what I was talking about, taking the fork in the road that goes toward an imperial presidency. When the presidency becomes imperial, well, you know, you do what you got to do, right? Right. Note coming in from Steve on the Gulf Coast, whistling past the graveyard. Bob, given a choice between seeing things as terribly grim or feeling like I have nothing better to do than stand around with my hands in my pockets waiting for the better times 20 to 30 years hence, I think I'll go for the first grim option. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm not playing fair with my assessment, but that is part of the problem. No, there isn't much most of us can imagine doing anymore. Not really. Democracy's a fine concept, but sure. But lack of anything approaching representation, that's just fatal. Well, maybe, and I think I understand what Steve is saying. Once you abandon, once you abandon hope, hope is a narcotic. Hope is dope. And once you realize that all there is the only thing you can do is work towards something with without necessarily any promise of return, well, then sometimes something happens. But there has got to be a great big getting off of asses before anything can happen. And the other thing that has to happen is the scab picking has to stop. Yesterday. So there's that. Steve from Georgistan asking, how much of a pain in the ass would it be to do a mobile from D.C., say, Tuesday and Wednesday of next week? You know, when we were going for a month at a time and we had an apartment and everything to live in D.C., I broadcasted, you know, every night. And it was extremely difficult. But you could set up the rig, and the rig was there, and you fired it up, and you went, and you did. To do that for a couple of times in the middle of the week, no. Because, see, the way it works when we go to do this work, you get up about 5:30 in the morning, and you do your shower and shave and all of that, and you get dressed, and then you battle your way from Manassas to D.C., and then you work D.C. all day long, and you don't even get home by 6, home being the motel. So getting back in time to be on the air is a near impossibility. And even if I did, I would be getting back in time to sit there and say, I have no idea what we're going to talk about tonight. So that's how that works. Steve, I appreciate what you say, and I've done it in the past, but on these over and back quickies, it's not really possible. Thanks, Jim says, what a great guest in regard to Ed Rabel. Ed and I had our differences about Hillary and Bernie. Ed said that this country was not ready for someone who was even in the same area code as the word socialist. And he was proven correct. A whole lot of the people who voted for Bernie in West Virginia were not Bernie voters. They were people who were doing what Trump told them to do and going and voting against Hillary in the primary. And that was, of course, proven in the general election results. So, you know, but the fact remains that there has got to be some sort of coming together in advance of 2018 and 2020, or the prophecy that I issued that I don't want to have come true, namely that we will wind up with the second term of Donald Trump, will come true. And it is entirely upon Democrats. And it's about getting out the vote. And it's about it. And you know what? You can reach out. You can reach out to the precious economic anxiety racists all you want. It ain't gonna help. They're not gonna stop being racists. And we might even have some evidence in that regard in fairly short order. But anyway, thank you, Glenn. Thank you kindly for getting us started. I hope Glenn will get some company. We are down to $368.70 to go for the evening. And I apologize again for fundraising. I apologize. I'm so sorry. But it's the only way we can keep this going. And even shaking out a handful of bananas only gets you so far, especially since they're imaginary. Also out there to talk about the German elections, which matter, because the Nazis got somewhere between 13 and 13.5% of the vote. Oh, Bob, come on, they weren't Nazis. That was just the alternative for Deutschland. They've got economic anxiety. Bullshit, they're Nazis, okay? They just aren't allowed to fly their preferred flag. That's why they show up at rallies with things like Confederate flags, right? Yeah. So anyway, we've got that, and there are people freaking out over that 13% in Germany, as well they should. So let's take a break and see what happens along the way. This is listener supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and we'll be back.
Yes, we can bomb most any land. On CNN with marching bands. Pour ourselves an ice cold coke. Make a war. Tell a joke. All there, all over me. The fear and insecurity. Yes, I am American. From Pearl Harbor to Afghanistan. Now Vietnam is history, and brother, that lesson didn't come for free. The politicians, they didn't bleed. Misguided patriots, indeed, indeed, indeed. Are we an empire? Loose, loose, fast. Or can we find a peace that'll last? Is the answer here at home? Home, 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 home. Or is it buried in a foreign storm?
It's Tuesday, September 26, 2017.
Almost a week after Maria hit, some isolated towns still have not been heard from at all.
Calls grow to accelerate disaster aid for Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Adding danger to desperation, major Puerto Rican dam at risk of total failure. Good news and bad from toxic Superfund sites flooded by Hurricane Harvey in Texas. Plus,
the oceans of 2017 are on track to be the third warmest on record.
Unusually warm oceans fueling record Atlantic storm season.
All of those record disasters and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Look, climate change is real. 99% of scientists know it's real. The whole world knows it's real, except for one person in the White House.
Shh, don't tell him. He's got bigger things to worry about. People are kneeling while the national anthem is playing. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we are now more than a week since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico. And things are getting worse there by the moment.
Yes. Now, some disaster aid has finally begun to arrive in Puerto Rico, where the wrath of Hurricane Maria caused catastrophic damage across the entire island's electricity, communications, water, and sewage infrastructure. Worse, the island is now in the midst of a record-breaking heat wave. Conditions are becoming desperate in some areas, according to Puerto Rico's Governor Ricardo Rossello, who, in an interview with PBS NewsHour, called on Congress to move more quickly.
The magnitude of this catastrophe is enormous. This is going to take a lot of help, a lot of collaboration. We are in the midst of potentially having a humanitarian crisis here in Puerto Rico, which would translate into a humanitarian crisis in the United States. So I call upon Congress to take action immediately. Puerto Ricans are proud U.S. citizens.
They are proud U.S. citizens. I can't imagine the government, the president, taking this long to take action had this been a city in the mainland U.S.
Yes. Now, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan said on Monday that Congress likely won't be taking up another disaster relief bill until mid-October.
Oh, take your time. What's the rush, Speaker Ryan?
Congressional Democratic leaders have called for the U.S. military to launch a large-scale recovery effort. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on Sunday said that in response to a direct request for state-to-state assistance from Puerto Rico's Governor Roselló, he is now sending New York's emergency recovery teams, supplies, and is launching a donation fund.
Instead of arguing with football players, instead of obsessing about how to take health care from the poor in this country, why don't we put the politics aside and focus on helping Americans in desperate need? And those are the people of Puerto Rico.
Tens of thousands have been evacuated from below the Oaxaca Dam in northwestern Puerto Rico, where flooding from Hurricane Maria has spilled over the dam, causing flash flooding downstream and is eroding its base. As we go to air, however, the dam itself is still intact. A further blow to Puerto Rico's economy and its future food supply. According to an initial assessment, the storm decimated at least 80% of this year's crops in Puerto Rico, and agriculture experts warn that damage to the soil, water, and infrastructure is so extensive that farmers may not be able to plant crops next year either.
What's going on in Puerto Rico is extraordinary. The president tweeted finally about Puerto Rico on Monday night, as if to say, hey, too bad, Puerto Rico. Florida and Texas are doing great, but you guys were a mess to start with, so there's not much we can do to help you. It's frankly appalling and could well turn out to be Donald Trump's Hurricane Katrina at this rate.
And the corporate TV news media's Sunday news shows are also failing Puerto Rico. A new analysis by Media Matters finds that the five network Sunday talk shows devoted less than 1 minute combined to the U.S. territory's devastation. Meanwhile, in Houston, good news and bad news. The good news is that the EPA says it has removed more than 500 containers of, quote, potentially hazardous material from toxic Superfund sites that were flooded by Hurricane Harvey. But the bad news is AP reports the agency won't reveal what the hazardous materials are, which sites they came from, or whether there was or is any threat to human health.
Unbelievable.
Finally, the oceans in 2017 are on track to be the third warmest ever recorded. Climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, in an interview with 60 Minutes, said it will take time to determine the exact contribution of global warming to this latest round of disastrous hurricanes, but there are some things that scientists do know.
We can say absolutely without a doubt that this hurricane took place over altered background conditions. Our planet is very different today than it would have been 50 or 100 years ago.
It is, and the price that scientists like Catherine Hayhoe have been warning about is one that it looks like we are really beginning to pay. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Baby, if I could change.
And, oh, by the way, at 28 minutes past the hour, almost halfway through this Titanic Tuesday edition of The Horn on the 26th of September, 2017, polls will close in Talabama this evening in about 32 minutes, 7 p.m. Central Daylight Time, as Republicans, Democrats don't have to do this, they've already got their nominee, a fine fellow by the name of Doug Jones. Republicans will choose whether they want the strange guy or the Roy Tola to be their standard bearer in the Senate race. And since Republicans enjoy a registration margin of about 5-3 over Democrats in Talabama, even Doug Jones has to admit that he, in order to win, he'd have to have an uphill climb. So polls showed that the strange guy is trailing the Roy Tola by somewhere between 8 to 10 points going into the primary today. And Roy Tolamore has been trying to press his advantage. Last night, he had a big campaign event in Fairhope, Alabama, I think, which is down on the eastern side of Mobile Bay. And at that event, Roy Tolamore showed up dressed up like a cowboy and even brought a little pistol with him. No kidding. He drew a pistol on stage at a political rally in Alabama. Because, see, that works down there. I can't tell you how badly I wish I was kidding, but I'm not. We've got a brief excerpt from his little Clavering rally among the maggots. Here we go.
It's been very hard for my wife and myself to weather 2, nearly 3 months of negative ads that we couldn't answer with money because we didn't have it.
Yeah.
Ads are completely false. That I don't believe in the Second Amendment. I believe in the Second Amendment.
That's where he drew his freedom protecting shooting pistol, wearing his leather cowboy vest and his white hat. He's got the white hat because he's the good guy, and he would never be caught dead in a black hat, you know, because it's black.
You know, they say guns are bad, that they kill. Well, I know a lot about guns. I'm the one that has used guns in combat. I know what guns do. It's been very hard for my wife and myself.
Yeah, so he waves the bloody shirt, naturally, because you got to do that too. And he talks about how they didn't have no money. Well, remember, Roy Tolamore, who's poor Moore, he set up a foundation that paid him and his wife $1 million a year, and it's all tax free. Hallelujah, because of course it was a Christianity save the marriage from the homosexuals kind of foundation group, whatever. So there's a pretty good bet. There's a pretty good bet that Roy Moore will win this primary, and he will go into the general election in 2018 against Doug Jones. Well, wait a minute. I don't know. Do they have to have a special election this November? I'm not sure. Somebody get the research department on that. But anyway, this is a guy who in the past has said that he don't think no Muslims can serve in the Congress, you know, because they ain't Christian. Now, he has not said the same thing about being Jewish and in the Congress, because after all, we got us a Judeo-Christian tradition here in America. You'll notice it don't say Judeo-Christian Muslim tradition. Mm-hmm. This is a man who instructed courts to defy a Supreme Court ruling. He's going to be a real party in the Senate of the United States, unless, of course, there are enough people who come to their senses in the state of Alabama to vote for the guy who actually put Klansmen in prison for murdering little girls by bombing a church. Mm-hmm. And there is no greater proof, if he wins that nomination, there is no greater proof that the hardcore John Birch, weird-ass neo-Nazi, Klan sympathizer element of the Republican Party has become the mainstream base of the Republican Party, in case anybody was wondering. Thank you very kindly to Kitty. Thanks, Kitty. Thanks so much for jumping in there alongside Glenn. Thank you very much indeed. That takes us down to $348.70 to come up even with fundraising. Thank you, Kitty. Thank you so very much. James points out by email, Talabama voodoo hoodoo. Whichever candidate wins, Alabama Republicans will nominate someone strange. And that's where that came from. Oh, you guys are great. By the way, says James, Roy Moore was dressed as a cowboy but had a gangster's snub-nosed pistol. It just looked comical, like Steve Martin's cowboy routine in Parenthood. That is exactly it. I was looking at that still image going, what is it? And that's it. It's Steve Martin with the cowboy and the hat and the vest on in the movie Parenthood. It is exactly that. Wait a minute. I got a cowbell to give out for that. Great observation. Great observation, James. Thank you. Jim, get your mind out of the gutter. Jim wants to know, was he wearing chaps to his well-shown ass? If he gets to the Senate, we're going to have lots and lots and lots of these kinds of opportunities. It's Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, which means that we have Titanic work to do. And I got a stack. I really, really do. Let's see. We got to go there. As you heard on the Green News Report, it is Puerto Rico's fault that Maria hit Puerto Rico. But it gets worse than that. Here's the audio. It was out in the Rose Garden today as Spanish Prime Minister, where's his name? As the Spanish Prime Minister, whose last name is Rajoy, I just don't know his first name, came to visit. I'm just gonna say this. Maybe civilized leaders of civilized countries should stop coming and paying court to Donald Trump. He loves that shit, and it legitimizes him. So, Prime Minister of Great Britain, Prime Minister of Spain, Prime Minister of Prime Minister, Prime Minister. How about y'all, not that we don't like you or anything, how about y'all stop coming and making him look normal? Please. Pretty please. And thank you. Oh, and thank you to the research department, namely Sparky. The winner of Tuesday's Republican primary runoff will advance to the December general election and face off against Democratic candidate Doug Jones. So they'll have a general election in December, and the winner will immediately take that Senate seat. It would be brilliant I know there's disagreement, but it would. Joe Biden's coming down there, going to do some campaigning for Doug Jones. It's not like we've got anything else going on right now in the Democratic Party. Goddamn Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Got to say that. Sorry. She's not there anymore. So how about a little unity, and how about maybe putting some effort into this and at least making the race competitive and interesting, because this isn't, you know, this is a Senate race, and this is worth remembering. This is a Senate race. This isn't one of those places where gerrymandering can effectively change the outcome. This is a statewide race. Now, voter suppression still plays a role. But the biggest and ultimate form of voter suppression is to just have people stay home. You don't even have to work to suppress those votes. Folks just stay home. Oh, screw it. The Republicans going to win. We're going to have another. We're going to have a goddamn Klansman in the Senate. So what? How about folks don't stay home? What would happen if there was a huge, huge turnout in an election where the turnout wasn't expected to be not so much? That'd be kind of a shock. Note coming from Kim in New Jersey. Not scab picking. It would be nice if it was just scab picking. It's really an open wound because Bernie is still running. He will run in 2020, and if he doesn't get the nomination, his supporters will again not vote for the nominee. Trump will easily win. Biden and Bernie are fossils. Booker has baggage. Kamala, no, we are not electing a woman. None of these people can beat Trump. That's pretty grim. I think the first part of healing an open wound is to let it form the scab. And to that extent, maybe Kim's right, and maybe it is still an open wound. But if we could let it form a scab and then not pick it off, maybe, just maybe, my prophecies about 2018 and 2020 won't come true. And I have never wanted to be wrong about something more in my life. You know, one of these days we're going to have to go to video just so everybody can see the hand gestures. I mean, because we're all doing hand gestures now, but I have normal human-sized hands. You know something I thought of the other night? I would like to see Johnny Bench go to the White House. I'd like to see Johnny Bench shake hands with Donald Trump, because it would look like a human shaking hands with a kitten. Because Johnny Bench has abnormally huge hands, you know, because, you know, catcher. That's what made him a great catcher back in the day. Hall of Famer, that kind of thing. That just occurred to me. I thought I'd share it along the way. Let me be clear. I will support my party's nominee in 2020, just like I did in 2016, just like I did in 2012, just like I did in 2008, in 2004, in 2000, 1996, 1992, 1988, 1984. Those are all the presidential elections I've ever voted in, and I have supported my party's nominee, even though in a lot of those, my party's nominee was not my chosen candidate, because I wanted to try to stop the other guy. Well, stopping the other guy is at a level of importance now that cannot be calculated by modern mathematics. But then again, so it was in 2016. Kim says Biden and Bernie are fossils. Booker has baggage. Oh, Booker has lots of baggage. Kamala Harris has lots of baggage, too. She is way not nearly ideologically pure enough. Here's the problem, though. Nobody's ideologically pure enough. Bernie has gotten shit from his hardcores for saying that Russia meddled in the election, just like I predicted. It's not necessarily the politicians in this instance who are the problem. It's the people who are imposing the unreasonable and the impossible upon them. Will I vote for Bernie in 2020 if he runs as the Democratic nominee? Yes, I absolutely will. Would I vote for Hillary in 2020 if she were to run and get the nomination? Yes, I absolutely would. I'm trying to think of something, but you know what? We're probably not going to see any of those. Let me drop a little something interesting on you. Usually when somebody starts showing up in places they shouldn't be, it's a sign they're up to something. You know, if a guy with black pants and black shoes and a black turtleneck and a black toboggan is lurking around your back door in the middle of the night. He's somewhere he shouldn't be. And that means he's up to something. Well, guess who just came to West Virginia? Guess who just came to West Virginia and had no reason in the world to be in West Virginia? Mark Zuckerberg. The guy who got paid in rubles himself. Now, granted, $100,000 in rubles is piss. That's not even beer money to Mark Zuckerberg. But still, he got paid in rubles, baby. To run ads on Facebook. And, you know, this isn't even speculation. Facebook admits. And I don't care how many of the members of the Purity Patrol challenge it. Facebook admits they took money from the Russians to run ads to influence the American election. Period. Unchallengeable. Well, Mark Zuckerberg showed up in Cabin Creek, West Virginia recently to visit a clinic. I'm pretty sure that it wasn't, you know, he didn't have one of those situations where it hurt real bad when he peed and he just wanted to go somewhere where nobody would expect him to show up and go, "Oh, you're Mark Zuckerberg. Now, come on in here, honey. We treat that all the time. Now, drop your pants." Ow! That's not why I'm here. No, he's doing campaign-y things because Mark Zuckerberg has decided that he would like to be president of the United States. The guy who helped fuck up the 2016 election may want to be president of the United States, so naturally he's got to come and visit the little hillbillies. Yeah. Because all of a sudden Mark Zuckerberg's interested in West Virginia. Yeah, maybe he's going to open a server farm. No, come on. Wake up and smell the moonshine. Yeah, Asa, you got a point. Do you realize, Asa asks, we wouldn't be talking about any of this shit had Hillary just picked Bernie as a running mate instead of that pasty, doughy fart knocker from Virginia? Yes, because there's a record in the archives of this program of us talking about exactly that. But that's, you know, it's in the past. And it cannot be changed. So the question is, what do we do in 2018 and 2020? And since the Democratic Party isn't doing much of anything in December of this year, how about we pour some effort? Come on, really. Come on down and shake some hands and get some people excited, Barack. I know, nut country. But the future of this country is on the line. I've been thinking, if you guys would be interested, I might reach out and try to get Doug Jones on the program. It might be able to. Don't know, no promise, but might be able to. You might be interested to hear what a real, live, honest-to-Jesus Democrat from Alabama sounds like. Because they do exist. So, you know, maybe that's something to work on. So anyway, back to the Rose Garden this afternoon. And Kaiser Kumquat hosting the Prime Minister of Spain, whom he repeatedly, by the way, referred to as the President of Spain. Because he knows precisely as much about government, politics, civics, and forms of government as, you know, as a pissant knows about nuclear physics. And so it was that he, and Mariano Rajoy is the name of the Prime Minister of Spain. I'd forgotten the Mariano part. And so it is that he finally, someone told him, Mr. President, Your Excellency, Your Supreme, Magnificent, Giant-Handed Wonderfulness, my God, I've never seen such big hands, sir. Those are huge hands. Yes, they're very big. And they, you know, you're going to have to say something about Puerto Rico sooner or later. You're beginning to get some shit for it from people who aren't even inclined to give you shit. And so it is that we found out that, golly, we'd already be providing relief to Puerto Rico, but, you know, it's really, really good relief we're providing to Puerto Rico, but it, well, there are things that make it not as awesome as it could be.
This isn't like Florida, where we can go right up the spine, or like Texas, where we go right down the middle and we distribute. This is, you know, a thing called the Atlantic Ocean. This is tough stuff. The governor has been so incredible in his statements about the job we're doing. We're doing a great job.
The governor has not praised you, dipshit. The governor has talked about what relief efforts there are, and there aren't enough. But at least he didn't call the Atlantic Ocean tough stuff. At least he didn't call the Atlantic Ocean a bad hombre or crooked. Now, he professes to adore our military, but apparently the United States Navy is not capable of providing a massive relief effort to Puerto Rico, which is part of the United States. He only recently found that out, but it is. He didn't think we had to do anything about Puerto Rico because, well, it's Puerto Rico, different country. I said the other night, we need a Berlin airlift-style response to Puerto Rico. I've been proven correct again. There is a little bit being done, but I'm talking about using the Navy and the Air Force and the Coast Guard to fly things in like the Berlin airlift. Go look at the history of the Berlin airlift. How many planes landed every how many minutes to provide relief to a besieged city? Well, this is an entire island. Arthur, Lib Talker says Iraqi terrorists were right to attack WTC on 9/11. What? No. But there's an ocean there, so he can't just drive down to Texas. We can't just fly down, you know, we just go through the middle of Texas. The middle of Texas. The Texas Gulf Coast is in the middle of Texas. Or go right up the spine of Florida. Up? That would mean that you were starting in Key West and going north. Donnie, Washington, D.C. is not south of Florida. Jesus Christ.
The governor has been so incredible in his statements about the job we're doing. We're doing a great job. Don't forget, their police force has been decimated because many of the police in Puerto Rico have lost their homes.
That's what he's worried about, the police? The police are a tiny fraction of the population of Puerto Rico. What was said in the Green News report? There are entire communities, not that don't have water, or, you know, that haven't had, you know, electricity for. There are entire communities that have not been heard from. So you don't know if it's. We don't even know how bad what we don't know how bad is. And this guy's talking about the police force?
So, sure, they want to be police, but they also want to be able to watch their families and find their families, and they have to live. So we're also very much involved in security in Puerto Rico. So everybody has said it's amazing the job that we've done in Puerto Rico.
No one has said that. Everyone has said it's amazing that Puerto Rico is being ignored as though it were some third world country filled with people who aren't as white as Donald Trump likes them to be. Holy. Well, everything has to be about this demented, to him, everything has to be about his demented, megalomaniacal self. He cannot talk about someone else's monumental suffering without talking about how awesome he is. And meanwhile, as Ed Rabel noted, the Republicans in Congress are going, yeah, that's our president.
Very proud of it. And I'm going there on Tuesday. Now, with all of that being said.
Yeah, 2.5 weeks later, he's going there. Good for you. Oh, well, you know, let's get you the Presidential Medal of Congressional Medal of. Oh, hell, let's give you the Nobel Prize. You poor suffering angel.
Record, if you look at the amount of water dropped on that island between the two hurricanes, and the first they just barely got by with, but they were devastated.
Really? A weather report? We don't know why Puerto Rico's in trouble? Okay, I'm trying. Silent R. Lamar says, please, Bob, look on the bright side. He could send American cops, and then the dead count will rise. Remember, they're not white. That's true. Steve in New York says, on a total aside, am I weird or petty or vindictive to begin a lock him up meme? Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. No, none of the above. He should be met, but of course, in this fascist coup in which we live, he never goes anywhere that he can hear people chant, lock him up at him. And sure, start it as a meme. What he needs, though, is to hear it. He needs to be somewhere where someone can read the first paragraph of Cicero's In Catilinam right at him. I mean, some of it's been done. We know, for instance, that he watches Chris Hayes' program. Back last month when I was in New Orleans. And they asked me if I could, you know, have a little chat with Chris on air. I said, sure. They got me to a studio. And between Chris and me, we upbraided him for not declaring the opioid crisis to be a national emergency. And the next day, boom, there it was. And Chris had previously highlighted the fact that he had changed course on other things as a result of things that were shown only on All In with Chris Hayes. You have to be able to get things directly at him. Subject line, Trump in chaps, bad hombre. With regard to Puerto Rico, Jim asks, have aid ships even left port? There is some aid, but not nearly enough going down there. I've seen reports of some vessels arriving. To the best of my knowledge, the USNS Comfort is not down there. It should be down there. You know, a week ago or more, there are people, old folks and infants and at-risk newborns who badly need to be evacuated from there.
And the second was a complete wipeout. I mean, this was a place that was destroyed.
Okay. He's so proud of himself because he's just learned that Puerto Rico was destroyed, and he wants to. He wants to share it with the world. But that wasn't all there was to the Rose Garden stuff. Oh no. No. There was also the matter of him dealing with a question over the fact that he's been yammering on about the NFL. And remember, let me just throw this out there as an aside too. Part of the reason that he's so pissed off and that he can have his attention drawn to the NFL is because the NFL is another one of those places where he lost his ass, where he got beaten like a redheaded stepchild. That's just an old hillbilly saying around here. It's not, you know, not, no offense to the gingers. I are one, or were. I were one. But back in the mid-80s, you remember the USFL and the New Jersey Generals, which the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini bought? Mm-hmm. Well, then, it was his idea. The USFL had started out as a way to have football pretty much year-round. The USFL was going to play in the spring. The NFL was going to play in the fall. They weren't going to compete against each other. There were some wrinkles in the rules that you could go for two after a touchdown, things like that. The USFL had. The NFL didn't. The NFL now has it. But after the first season, Trump came in and bought the New Jersey Generals. And then he convinced the ownership of the USFL to go head-to-head against the NFL in the fall, and they got stomped. So then Trump cooks up the idea of, well, I'll sue the NFL, and we'll get great publicity, and we'll win, and they'll write us a big check, or else we'll have a merger like they did with the AFL and the NFL. Well, they went through the lawsuit, and the USFL actually won. And the jury awarded Donald Trump and the USFL $1. Then the USFL and Trump appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court let the verdict stand. And so the NFL was forced to cut a check because since there was fraud involved, it was triple damages, so $1 becomes $3. And then there was also the matter of the 76 cents in interest. And so the NFL was forced to cut a check to the USFL for $3.76. That's just a little bit more than you got for... No, that's less than you got for winning the damn gong show. And so, as Steve from Georgistan points out, the USFL went belly up just like everything King Orange touches. And he's still pissed about it. Because he didn't just get beat, he got stomped. He got humiliated. And so him trying to tell NFL owners what to do has roots back in his attempt to try to tell the NFL what to do back in the mid-80s. Just pointing that out because context is everything. And so he's asked out in the Rose Garden, well, what about all the time you're wasting on the NFL?
With the NFL instead of dealing with Puerto Rico, why isn't that a fair assessment?
Well, I wasn't preoccupied with the NFL. I was ashamed of what was taking place because, to me, that was a very important moment. I don't think you can disrespect our country, our flag, our national anthem.
None of which happened, of course.
To me, the NFL situation is a very important situation. I've heard that before about was I preoccupied. Not at all. Not at all. I have plenty of time on my hands. All I do is work.
Well, if all you do is work, then you don't have plenty of time on your hands. On the other hand, if you have plenty of time on your hands, you aren't working. And no, I'm not gonna stop the program and take a top of the hour bump, break and run too much time on my hands by sticks, although the temptation is profound. And by the way, with regard to Puerto Rico, Ron in the sandbox points out, not only are they not white, they aren't Republican. The movers and shakers in the Republican Party haven't exactly been beating the bushes to rustle up aid and support for Puerto Rico. Yeah, there's no bill out there. There's no billion-dollar package to get aid to Puerto Rico in the Congress. It doesn't exist. Because, you see, Texas and Florida can be counted on to vote, you know, against their own interests, and I realize there's a certain amount of snobism and elitism in me saying that. But Texas and Florida can be reliably voted, counted on to vote for Republicans. Puerto Rico, they can't do a goddamn thing for a Republican. Hence, Puerto Rico can pound sand. But that's where I've got lots of time on my hands. All I do is work. You know, when he's not playing golf more than any other president in the history of the country. When he's not on vacation. When he's not sticking it to the American people by billing the government for rooms in his skeevy-ass hotels.
And to be honest with you, that's an important function of working. It's called respect for our country. Many people have died. Many, many people. Many people are so horribly injured.
Not any of them, however, anything resembling remotely related to you or your family. Because your grandpappy was a goddamn draft dodger in Germany. He tried to leave America, go back to Germany, and they said, no, you got to get out of here. You're a draft dodger. You're a coward. He comes from a family of cowards. He's a coward. He had a sore foot, and that got him. That got his privileged white ass out of Vietnam. Fuck off.
I was at Walter Reed Hospital recently, and I saw so many great young people, and they're missing legs, and they're missing arms, and they've been so badly injured. And they were fighting for our country. They were fighting for our flag. They were fighting for our national anthem.
No. No, there is not. You go to Arlington. There is not a single person buried over there. There's not a single person who has ever fought for the national anthem. Jesus Christ, the stupidity of this of this intellectual. You flee. Is sometimes astonishing. Silent R. Lamar says, hey, Bobby's working all right. He's working on fucking Americans. You know, I think that's a byproduct, Lamar. What he's working on is enriching himself.
And for people to disrespect that by kneeling during the playing of our national anthem, I think is disgraceful.
And, of course, there's nothing about disrespect or, no. It is a silent protest, and this has largely been forgotten in all the Sturm und Drang. It is a silent protest against the ongoing crisis in this country of police violence against the community of color. Oh, okay. Okay, Earther's back with the program. Earther says, I'm sorry, Bob. My player was playing an old podcast. Thought it was the live show. It was the 9/11 episode. Well, maybe that explains part of the problem. I don't know. So, you know, we've got that going for us. And ever so much more. Big news coming out of Tennistan today. Bob Corker, who was up for re-election, has declared as of today that he will not run to be returned to his Senate seat in 2018. leaving that seat then wide open. All of a sudden, putting a crack in the solid South by making a real effort in Alabama takes on a little bit more significance, doesn't it? Chinless Mitch McConnell had a no good, very bad, really terrible day. First, he had to admit that the latest attempt to deprive millions of Americans of access to health insurance had failed. And then, lo and behold, Bob Corker says he's not going to run for re-election. Now, Bob Corker is one of that tiny little handful of Republicans. All they had to do was win in reliable states, and Mitch McConnell gets to go on being majority leader. Now it looks like, unless there's a dramatic change in the primary results in Alabama tonight, it looks like a guy who has campaigned on how much he despises Mitch McConnell, namely Roy Tolamore, will be the Republican nominee and the odds-on favorite to fill that seat. And a guy who could have stomped kittens in the middle of Lower Broad in Nashville, Corker, will not be seeking re-election himself, making at least a contest, a little bit of one, for that junior Senate seat from Tennessee. So, could Democrats get their shit together and find a good candidate to run for that seat? Don't know. Just don't know. It would be a good time to find out, though. So, just as a reminder, here at 11 minutes past the hour, we have $348.70 to raise to get out of the red and make it a little more hopeful that we will get to the end of the week and finish fundraising for the month okay as we go into our anniversary month here. $348.70. So, you know, help if you can. If you can't, you can't. Jack in Shreveport with a note says, Puerto Rico cops, I'll bet Trump is fixated on the police because in his mind, property and stores have to be protected from looting. Yeah. James says, one name. Zuckerberg needs one name whispered in his ear, Michael Huffington. That's the candidate, a one-term congressman from Texas, California, who thought that if he just massively outspent Dianne Feinstein, he could buy a U.S. Senate seat. And yes, he was Arianna Huffington's, well, she was his beard, wife. Yeah, right. I remember. Regarding Zuckerberg, Don in West Tennistan says, damn, Bob, I've already fallen off my chair once, Ivanka. Now, Zuckerberg, give me a break. I'm getting bruises all over my body. I'm sorry. Do we need to start running a warning before the program? I understand. And look, you think you got bruises? This stuff happens inside my own head. Meanwhile, thank you, Robert, in Australia, for this for the international perspective. Everyone in the USA knows the U.S. is ignoring Puerto Rico. Everyone outside the USA knows Puerto Rico was flattened 2 weeks ago. Everyone outside the USA knows Puerto Rico needed immediate aid 2 weeks ago. They're all U.S. citizens, after all, even if they didn't want to be when the U.S. invaded Puerto Rico. So this is America being great? Pretty much, Robert. You know, if Puerto Rico would pay the debts that it owes to Wall Street and the banks, because that's how they got themselves in so much trouble, because they got a terrible, terrible infrastructure, and they owe so much to Wall Street and the banks. Is that miserable little puke trying to hold Puerto Rico hostage, actually trying to shake them down before we go in and try to find just how much? Because we don't know. We don't have a death toll in Puerto Rico. because there are places people can't get to still. And there's the dam that failed. Some are beginning to refer to Puerto Rico as, you know, as Trump's Katrina. It may turn out to be Katrina times a thousand. And that is a horror too much to contemplate. And see, we're not gonna have any airlifts of Puerto Ricans up to Florida or anywhere else, because they might go up there and go, "Hey, you know, those Republicans left us to die. Well, now we're here. We're voting." They will not take that risk. Oh, no. Oh, no. So, Steve asks, since when is playing golf work? All right, a lot of business gets done on the golf course, Steve. A lot of business. A lot of business. Yeah. Meanwhile, with another pertinent question, Marty asks, and what does old Mar-a-Lago Mussolini say about goddamn Tim Tebow when he kneels for the damned anthem? Well, he's kneeling for Jesus, you know, and Jesus is a very great guy, and more people are finding out every day about the work that Jesus is doing, and I have a feeling he'll be getting more popular. Ouch. Thank you, Jack in Shreveport, very, very kindly. We're taking some bites out of this, so that takes us down to, oh, we cracked the $300 level, so we are down to $298.70. Get even. Thank you, Jack. Thank you very, very much. There really are bills to pay here. I don't get all this stuff, you know, on good looks. You know, the power company doesn't show me, "Oh, Bob, you're a great guy. No, you get free electricity. Let's go blow up another mountain. Just for you, Bob." Nope, doesn't work that way. Arthur says, it may be naive of me, but I say give Puerto Ricans the chance to vote to either become an independent nation or to become another state in the Union. Yeah, I'm kind of there, too. And, by the way, with regard to Tangerine Tiberius saying that you people who died for that anthem, Sparky points out, the oath you take when you join the military has nothing to do with a fucking flag. It's about defending the Constitution and all enemies, foreign and domestic. Hey, look, we've got a domestic one. Oh, well. Silent R. Lamar asks, Bob, do the people who love the flag of America understand the things that are done under the flag of America at home and abroad? No, they don't. And this has nothing to do with the flag, and it has nothing to do with the national anthem. It has to do with him motivating a racist base. A racist base. Who have a lot of guns. Whom he thinks he can call on when the jig is finally up. And he needs to get his civil war on. All right, let's go over and check with the long patient. I just had to get some of that stuff out of the way, or dealt with, or at least reported. Let's check in with Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
I'm okay. Let me turn off this wind machine, because it's probably making way too much noise, and that's Punky's job, after all. Okie dokie. How you doing?
The evening is flying by.
I just noticed two things on my Facebook as I was listening and waiting. One of them was a note from The Hill, the publication The Hill, that Barack Obama and George W. are doing fundraising for the situation in Puerto Rico, which is nice. And I just noticed something from one of the sisters of my older brother's first wife, asking a friend of hers, so how was the rapture for you? Was that last Saturday or is it
No, that was Saturday. We're still here.
Okay.
Well, apparently it didn't happen because the evangelical fundamentalists are still here too, so okay. we'll have to figure out a way to make the world better even with them still here.
All right. Well, this gives you a rough idea of just how little attention I pay to such nonsense.
With a little more planning, we could have put Agnes's idea into play, and I swear it would have been an awesome thing just to let a whole bunch of blow up dolls filled with helium and some little weights on their feet to keep them oriented in the right direction. Just let them go and start flying up into the sky, and just have a few people planted there, have some videos going, and having a couple of people planted to yell, "Oh my God, it's the rapture, they were right!"
When you mentioned that, about a week or two ago, whenever it was, I want you to know, well, you and Agnes by extension, both of you are responsible for some amount of coffee going through my nose, and it was hot coffee, because I had just that instant taken a fairly substantial gulp, and when you were relating that idea, some of that coffee went through my nose. So
well, and it's only funny because you know that there would be in a place like this a certain amount of people who'd go, "Oh my God, why am I still here?"
Oh yeah, yeah. But I'd have one more question, and then I have a serious question.
Yes.
The silly question is, Manassas? How have you ended up in Manassas for a trip to D.C.?
That's where we stay because that's where the hotels get cheap.
God. And do you know who used to live in Manassas?
You?
No.
Your aunt with the dead bird.
Yeah, whose name actually was Snooky. I forgot that
Snooky,
his name was
yes,
Snooky.
Snooky.
Yeah. Yeah, Aunt Josephine. Spent many happy hours down there on the family land.
Well, I don't know how long it's been since you've been there, but I'll bet you it's got a Dick's Sporting Goods or something on it now.
Well, I'll tell you how.
Because I mean, you get off of I-66 there, and it's nothing but sprawl.
I left the D.C. area in early 1982. I visited from time to time, not lately. Hell, next year it'll be 20 years since I've been back there. And everybody tells me it's changed tremendously. But the last time I was down there at Aunt Anna's place, which was right next door to Aunt Josephine's place, I was still married to my first wife, which we got married in 86. So it was a couple of years after that because Aunt Anna was taking care of my paternal grandmother who had Alzheimer's. And she thought I was her next to youngest son. That's how far gone she had gotten.
So did they live like in town in Manassas?
Oh, I wish I could remember the name of the little burg.
Because, I mean, you drive a ways down Sudley Farms Road. And that's all just mall sprawl.
All right, they lived in or near a little place called Hoadley, wherever that is. It's like a little area of near Manassas. I could if I were back there tonight, I could probably get in a car and take you there, and because I know the houses are still there. And they were from, you know, they weren't, but their parents were from Eastern Europe, Bulgaria, basically. And they used to have a ethnic picnic every season, every fall, I guess it was, or late summer, with polkas and God knows what else. And the food, oh, Bob, talk about food.
Oh, I have no doubt. I have no doubt. Well, when you get off I-66 now, there's a Cracker Barrel right next to the battlefield. There's all kinds of stuff that was built right on, because the battle didn't just take place on the battlefield. There's a whole bunch of area that's all paved over and retailed and everything. There's a Costco, Dick's Sporting Goods, various grocery stores, lots of various hotels and motels, from Super 8 on up. And there was a lot of archaeological history that was lost.
Oh yeah.
In that development. But yeah, so that's you do one of two things. You either, and it doesn't matter what time you leave. If you leave at 7 o'clock, it's damn near 2 hours into DC. And if you leave at 8 o'clock, it's 2 hours into DC. If you leave at 9 o'clock, it's 2 hours into DC. You know, for a 45-mile drive.
Well, once upon a time, a little closer in, off of 95 or right on, or I don't even know if they renumbered that. I think they call that 395 now. The north-south route between D.C. and Richmond and Point South used to be I-95, but I think they renumbered it. There was a time when people who commuted in from Woodbridge, Virginia, were considered absolutely crazy because it was so far out in the burbs.
Yeah.
And we're talking 40 years ago or more. Now that's nothing.
And they won't have the metro to Manassas within my lifetime, or maybe even the lifetime of my kids.
Is it even going there? I thought
no. It stops at
Tyson's Corner, probably.
No, Vienna Falls Church.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do if you want to take the metro in. You go down, you fight for a parking space at Vienna Falls Church, and you get on the metro. If you can get a parking space. If you can't get a parking space, you fight your way back onto I-66 and go on into town and park at Union Station.
And even though the metro is pretty much completed, at least they're what they initially thought it would be, it is not what it used to be. Because the problem is you've got the district, you've got Maryland, and you've got Virginia, and plus the federal government. So you've got four different governmental entities, okay, who fund the thing, all right? And all of them are pleading poverty and have since the thing was developed. And I rode the first little leg of that thing the first day it opened in 1976. And it was only like three stops, if that, I think from DuPont Circle. I forget where all it went.
No, that's the red line.
The red line, yeah. That was the initial.
Probably Union Station to DuPont Circle.
No, I don't even think it was to DuPont Circle. I mean, to Union Station. It might have been, but it seems to me it was only like two or three stops. And this is the very first day, the first part of it that opened. I'll have to look it up. But... And they've put off repairs and stuff, and it's sad because once upon a time it was the most amazing up-to-date mass transit system on the planet. Not just in the U.S., but literally on the planet. It was.
It's still pretty impressive.
Well, it is. But those.
I mean, for a hillbilly, at least.
Well, you always get. Impressions of Star Trek when those doors open, you know?
Yeah. I get impressions of Klingons when you figure out that those things will close on you and the train will leave. They're not kidding.
I used to live in a little...
on my arm.
In the late 70s, I used to live on the top floor of Hunting Towers, of which there's only one of the original three towers left as you come over to the Virginia side of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, which is not the same bridge anymore. But I lived on the eighth floor in a little studio apartment, and I would get on the bus. I worked in D.C. over by HUD, I think it was, Housing and Urban Development. Had a night job, 5:30 to 12, doing telemarketing.
Speaking of which, there's a HUD story. Someone filed a Freedom of Information Act request against HUD because Ben Carson is trying to turn it into a little personal fiefdom for him and his family.
Oh, good.
And the response came back, none of your damn business.
Well, there you go. That's your Trump government. That's
there's supposed to be legal remedies to keep that from happening, but so far not
well,
so
I
much.
I know. But anyway, I would take the bus to the airport. By that time, it was built out to National Airport. I'll never call it Reagan National. And I'd get off the bus, get on the subway, and it didn't even go over the river. You had to go up past Crystal City and the Pentagon, and under the water, at Key Bridge.
Right. And it pops out at the Roslyn station.
Yeah. But once I was off at L'Enfant Plaza, which was the station nearest where I worked, it was like a block and a half. And I could read. They didn't have really personal listening devices too much back in the 70s that I recall, other than transistor radios. But, oh, man, I used to read a hellacious amount on that long bus and subway ride.
Yeah, I can't. I can't read on a bus. I'll get dog sick in a minute. But I understand.
Well, anyway, you'll be happy to know that I have done a little bit of research, and I think I'm getting to the bottom of this. And what I'm getting to the bottom of. You mentioned with Bob Rabel to
Ed Rabel.
Ed Rabel. You're Bob, and he's Ed.
Last I checked.
The thing about David A. Koch, or David H. Koch, partial funding of this Vietnam War documentary. And you had mentioned it once before, or maybe even twice before last week. And I said, well, I'm going to do a little research and see what I can find out, because Bob raises an excellent point. How much do you think the budget was for that entire documentary? The thing was
10 years in the making.
Yeah, but
it had to be huge. I don't know. Do you know that? Did you find it?
Yeah,
number?
I found out today actually.
Okay, shoot.
In a little article about it last week in the Cleveland Plain Dealers website online. They're quoted as saying that it was produced at a cost of $30 million, which was lower than I thought it would be, given that it was 10 years. And I got to thinking, well, how did they do that? Did they do $3 million a year, or did they give him the entire $30 million, or how did that work exactly? And I haven't found that out, but I sent you the funding page.
Right. And the thing is, on that funding page, if you go through and you start looking up some of those other family foundations,
mm-hmm.
David Koch is just the tip of the right-wing iceberg.
Well, it turns out it's 27 either individuals, foundations, corporations, or other entities of one sort or another. Everything from the Koch to Bank of America to PBS.
Yeah, Bank of America, who maybe... got in on it because they remembered the time that one of their branches got burnt down in a protest. That happened. That's a thing that happened.
And didn't General Motors used to be a big funder of his earlier documentaries? They've disappeared. I guess that's part of the when they almost went under. Maybe they reorganized their funding priorities or something. But I don't know. Probably there's got to be paperwork somewhere that's available to the public or accessible or findable that indicates who gave what. But my main question is, these people who fund these things, other than the end product of a documentary of 18 hours in length and 10 segments, what are their expectations? I would think that a filmmaker has to have some integrity, a documentarian, in the sense of, you know, what you're going to get for your money is the fucking documentary, and stay out of editorializing. I mean, in a perfect world, it would be that way. One would hope.
Yeah. Well, and we're talking about these people. David H. Cook comes up, but prominently also featured is the Blavatnik Family Foundation.
Yeah, I wondered who the hell they were. They
well, I looked it up.
All right.
That would be
you.
Sir Leonard Len Blavatnik, Soviet-born British-American businessman, investor, and philanthropist. In 2015-2016, he donated a total of $7.35 million to Republican, and I do mean only Republican, political candidates, and he also gave a cool $1 million to the committee for the inauguration of Donald Trump.
Hmm.
So well, that's the money that's behind Ken Burns.
But again, what is their expectation? I doubt that. Well, I don't know that much about Ken Burns other than.
Oh, he's supposedly liberal.
Well, I sent you some stuff about John Barber, the guy who not long ago did a new JFK documentary.
Yeah.
You know what his comment about the Vietnam War documentary was?
What?
Ken Burns should stick to baseball and jazz. Now, he said that before the first frame was ever shown on TV, but
right, but there were a lot of people who got to review it before it ever aired.
Yeah. Maybe he did. I don't know.
And I don't know about you. You're watching it, or have watched it, I trust. I know. We talked.
Every night. And I'll tell you, Bob, this is going to be a program that will bear subsequent viewings over the years, by me anyway, and probably, most likely, additional reading and research and reflection and contemplation. Because I'm telling you, man, I've been almost at the point of tears watching some of this documentary. And I'm an old, crusty old curmudgeon a lot of the time.
And for me,
it takes a bit to move me.
Yeah, oddly enough for me, it's the first episode that brought out some of that for me, because there were opportunities for it not to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we let it, it's not like we were led innocently into it.
Well, I think we had a mass case of magical thinking working for us.
Well, we had Korea behind us, and golly, we were the heroes of the Second World War, and so we're a superpower, damn it. We can do anything we want to.
But to
return to your previous question, what do these billionaires, these billionaire right wing plutocrats, oligarchs, what do they want out of this? Why did they give the money? I think it's to make, even though Burns puts forward some of the nastiness that went down, he scratches the surface of it, okay? And it's one of those mistakes were made kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he also dishes it out and we did some awful shit, but so did the North Vietnamese. Well, okay, of those two people, us and the North Vietnamese, there's only one group whose country it was. Hint, not us.
Yeah.
Okay? And so there's, yes, he has a couple of people tell some war crime stories. Yes, he talks about the Tiger Unit. But overall, it comes. Well, you know, this was a noble undertaking. It was a noble undertaking that was done. Maybe we shouldn't have gotten into it, but gosh, we sure were noble for the most part in what we did.
Yeah, but I think back to Errol Morris's documentaries about 10 years ago, "The Fog of War," which I recommend to anybody if you've not seen it. He basically, the subject of his documentary is Robert Strange McNamara, who was the originally President Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, former Ford Motor Company president.
Yeah.
called into the government to run the Department of Defense, which is fine if there's nothing going on, okay? That's a bureaucrat's job, basically. But you bring the scenario of a conflict into it, because it never was a declared war. Vietnam wasn't. And one of the things that just made me almost weep was a couple of episodes back where they said he was a number cruncher and a bean counter and a technocrat, you know, and what he did, he wanted data, just data out the ass. And they would enter it into 3x5, or not 3x5, but punch cards, IBM
sure.
punch cards, run it through whatever the computer was in those days, hoping for a usable answer. Well, that's not the way to do a war. That's not really the way to do anything, in my estimation.
Well, as Ron and Raleigh points out, well, hell, Bob, those billionaires are just doing their civic duties. And if you believe that, and if I believe that, we should run right out and buy a bridge in Brooklyn.
Yeah, they all of a sudden have an interest in good filmmaking. I don't buy that either. Okay.
Right. So what you've got, what you've got is a
I
picture,
Scott. I
just
want to find out what it is.
What you've got, though, is a picture of American imperialism. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a damning picture of American imperialism. It creates, it does. I mean, you've seen it. It creates this lost cause narrative that then can be extended into things like Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah, because the message has been so thoroughly muddied. It's not we never should have gone in the first place, which is, you know, the message in Afghanistan and Iraq, too. It's that, darn it, you know, we had the best intentions. We just didn't really understand the nature of the war that we were fighting. Okay,
well,
I understand the nature of that war, Scott.
I do, too.
And there were political dynamics with the Soviet Union and the Chinese. And in former times, ancient times, if you will, if you want to do a war like Vietnam, you move in, you kill everybody, and you resettle it. Now, that was not practicable, but that's kind of what you do. Because we've also got ancient exemplars of attempts at pacification from 2,500 years ago. Alexander went in and tried to pacify Afghanistan. And sooner or later, he had to march out, and it went right back to shit again, and it was a problem. And it remained a problem. That area was a problem for the Medes, the Persians. Because there's no such thing as pacification. You either kill everybody and move somebody else in, and that has happened. Or you don't do it. You know, they invade you, fine. But the only reason you do something like that is an expansion of empire. And this was an expansion of empire. What? And this is one of the questions that doesn't get asked, unless you've heard it asked and I haven't. I mean, maybe I looked away or something. What would have happened if we'd won?
Good question. I haven't heard it posed in the documentary.
Would Vietnam have become? Would Vietnam have just remained a puppet colony of the United States?
That's a damn fine question. We would have benefited from when I say we, I don't mean the two of us. I mean we, the military-industrial complex, congressional complex, military-industrial-congressional complex, would have found a way to benefit from whatever resources, human and natural, in Vietnam, and it would have been hands off. They would have let governments and governors run it, more than likely. In other words, I wouldn't have counted on a new star being added to the fucking flag. Hell, if Puerto Rico can't become a state, then I doubt that the nation of Vietnam, had we won, would show any likelihood of becoming a state. I mean, we went as far as Hawaii, and there were people who didn't think that was such a good idea. You know, 60 years, almost 60
but Hawaii,
years ago.
But Hawaii became a state, and Puerto Rico didn't, because Hawaii had strategic value. Vietnam would have had strategic value.
Oh, shit, yeah. Well, look at Guam.
But the reason we don't ask that question about Vietnam is because there was no way to ever win. The only way, we could have stayed there. We could have continued to send troops and troops and troops and occupied and occupied and occupied, but it never would have been more than occupied Vietnam. We wouldn't have had as much success with it as the French did.
Even early on, 65, 66, in those tapes, which were actually dictabelts that LBJ used. They're showing a tape machine, but they were actually dictabelts.
Right.
But in these private conversations that he was having with Richard Russell and Eisenhower the other night, and McNamara and the Bundys, just all the private conversations, even as early on as 65, LBJ knows in his heart of hearts that he's on a fool's errand engaging in this. He's of two minds about it, too. That's the pitiable thing. He knows in his heart of hearts that he's going down a very, very bad road.
And it gets even sadder, because he could have been another FDR if he had stuck to domestic policy.
Bingo, yeah. You read my mind, you know? And he could have been, and was on track to do it. But it's that old guns and butter thing. You can't serve two masters, in this case, the military-industrial congressional complex, or the needs of the people. And now they don't even put up, you know, you fast forward 50 years later, today, in today's world, look at Trump and Puerto Rico. They don't even put up a pretense. They don't even pretend that they give a flying fuck about the people.
No.
You know?
And it's certainly not. And you know, when you consider the vast amount of resources that it took to get to keep a half million man standing army in a place halfway around the world, and yet in 2017, I say Berlin airlift. You know, it is not logistically impossible for a military of the likes we have to do something like that. We got a bunch of C-130s sitting on a blown up mountaintop down in Charleston that could be eminently useful in something like that.
What, for Puerto Rico?
Yeah. We have the Seabees in the Navy, and we have the engineering battalions, the Army Corps of Engineers. You could cut out runways to get emergency relief in. And you know what? They need that emergency relief. Puerto Rico is worthy of a Berlin airlift kind of effort.
Well, they are our citizens, although I bet you if you ask certain number of people in certain areas, they're not even aware of that.
Oh, half the people in the state I'm in think Puerto Rico is a foreign country.
Yeah. Well, they think Africa is a country. Africa is a continent.
Yeah, but Puerto Rico is, you know, here. And a significant number of the people in the United States don't give a goddamn, because I hate to keep returning to this, somewhere around 30-35% of this country is racist and bigoted as hell. And they hate Mexicans, and anybody who speaks Spanish is a Mexican. I've got audio of a kid sitting in a high school in Charlotte, North Carolina. I didn't play it. He's sitting in a high school classroom in Charlotte, North Carolina, and a substitute teacher begins screaming at him, "You want to speak Spanish in my class? You go back where they speak Spanish. Yeah, I'm racist."
Jesus.
That's a guy on the payroll of the public school system of Mecklenburg County, North Carolina.
Jeez.
And some kid caught it with his or her cell phone. And I got a dozen other stories, or a half dozen.
Something you said earlier in conversation, and I don't know whether it was with Ed or whether it was after that, and I need clarification. You were saying that there are some who are saying it's Puerto Rico's fault that they're in
the... That's what Trump said.
Okay. What, because they were third in line after
What he tweeted out, Scott, was that Puerto Rico got really hurt by Maria, but Puerto Rico was already in a terrible mess in the first place. Their infrastructure was all beat up, and they owe lots of money to the banks and Wall Street.
Well, we see where his attention is. Oh, did you hear the good news? I'm surprised you didn't mention it. Maybe you didn't hear it. There was a report on, and I'll have to send you the link. Apparently, the people in charge of such things are considering doubling the amount of space that you can devote to a tweet, going from 140 to 280.
Oh, God,
now,
please.
What is that going to mean? Will there be fewer tweets because they'll be twice as long, or will that be like...
it'll just be people that... I don't know. There'll be more room for emojis.
No, I'm talking about the orange tweeter, the trooper.
But overall, what there's a trend going on in Twitter where people tweet and then subtweet. Okay, they start out and you hang the number one and a slash and an X. So you know one of however, two of however, and you tweet and then you reply to the tweet and you reply to that tweet and you reply to that tweet. And you're basically writing prose on Twitter 140 characters at a time. And there's a lot of that.
I tried Twitter. Oh God.
Twitter is brokered in the Ten Commandments. They're not making money.
Yeah.
And they have the horrible, horrible problem of not policing their the hate that that just flows like a river there. They've got these terms of conduct and you know community rules and shit, but there's one person that they do not apply to, and that's Trump.
Yeah, obviously.
There's one person on Twitter who more than anybody else needs to be banned from Twitter, and that's Donald Trump. And they don't have the guts to do it.
Well, a lot of people were hoping that General Kelly, becoming chief of staff, would take away Trump's device, so that he wouldn't be able to tweet.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
Well, they're doing it the wrong way. Twitter needs to say, look, we've been getting complaints, and we want you to just stop, and we're going to enforce that. Have a nice day. So long. Live long and win many prizes, you know? But they won't. You're right. They got no guts.
And if anybody else tweeted the kind of vulgar filth that he's tweeted, you'd get bounced.
Oh, yeah. Any of us would be out on our butt. And it wouldn't have taken, it would have been handled in pretty short order.
But see, there's another problem that obtains with Trump, Scott, if I can just interject for a moment.
No, that's your show.
And that is this, well, I try to be a genial guy. And
Listen, if you got any more genial, I would be suspicious.
But... There's this idea of controlling Trump, okay? And it has a historical precedent of failure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I realize, only Hitler can be Hitler, all right? But there's a difference between saying Trump is Hitler or even Trump is like Hitler. That's not what I'm saying. But when Adolf Hitler rose to the chancellery, Paul von Hindenburg... I believe it was, said, I will handle this Hitler. Because, you know, Paul von Hindenburg was, you know, part of the, you know, the power elite of Germany. And he was a mover and a shaker. I will handle this Hitler. And there were other people. I will handle this Hitler. Nobody handled him. He was unhandleable. Okay? And now we've got the same goddamn thing going on. John Kelly's the chief of staff. He'll handle Trump for us. You know, bullshit. He's on that chief of staff because there is some element within him that agrees with Donald Trump. H.R. McMaster is on the Trump administration because there is some portion of him that agrees with Donald Trump. They're not going to handle shit. They're going to try to do damage control so that he won't hurt himself so badly that he can't do the awful things that people like Kelly and McMaster want him to do.
Well, I don't know that in his, 72, 73, something like that?
Yeah, 71, 72.
I don't think in his entire life anyone has ever said no to him and put some muscle behind it in the sense of enforcing the no that they've set down. I don't think anybody, now true, his parents sent him to military school, but I think that was less about saying no than just getting him. Can you imagine raising that guy?
Oh, no, they just wanted him out of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And Fred wasn't well healed enough to send him to one of those legacy places like Andover where George H.W. and the Quaker Oats man, his wife, sent George.
No.
And Jeb. So they sent him to some military school where he spent a lot of time. And they hoped it might, you know, drain a little of, I'm guessing here, they hoped it might go a little of the way toward giving him some discipline if it didn't actually, you know, if it wasn't successful in turning him into a tolerable human being.
No, we're talking Trump, not W.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the stories that I've read are that he got the lay of the land and actually molded it to his
he bullied his way in.
Yeah.
So, you know, this notion of someone handling Trump is a giant steaming load of crap.
Well, I was just quoting what some people, you know, when they brought Kelly in after rinse and repeat Priebus went away, some were speculating that Kelly, being a general, would have some sway over Trump.
Yeah, no, I wasn't getting after you, but it's just it's ridiculous to think that there is that anyone is going to control or B, even want to control. And yeah. Lo and behold, I just checked 2 hours ago. He was tweeting Mariano Rajoy, the Prime Minister of Spain, was there. Like I said, he constantly referred to him as the President of Spain.
Yeah,
and so all of a sudden on his Twitter feed, I want to express our support and extend our prayers to all those affected by the vile terror attack in Spain last month. Last month. He just got around to it. The guy that said he's got so much time on his hand just got around to condoling Spain for having a terrorist attack last month.
Jeez. I remember something in Spain, but...
In one of the high tourist areas.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right. Well, that's just the thing. Now, I'm somebody who stays on top of stuff, by and large, okay? But shit is happening so fast and furious, Bob, that even events like that in recent weeks, you lose track of them because some new and worse thing
without a doubt. Yeah.
Every day we wake up wondering if today will be the last day. You know, is this where we all say, will today be the day that we all say, today is a good day to die? You know,
And
no,
not,
it's the
day.
No, what we're
guilty.
Worried about is that he wakes up and it says it's today is a good day for somebody else too.
Yeah,
but I got to get out of here, Scott. We're right at the end.
Okay, Bob. I'll keep doing research because it is a fascinating thing to figure out.
Well, it is, and go read up on the Blavatniks. Great bunch.
God, what a name.
Yeah.
All right, take care, Bob.
All right, see you, Scott. And so we're out of here. The best laid plans of mice and men. We'll get out of here. We'll still have a deficit tomorrow. But Glenn jumped in, who got us started this evening. Glenn jumped in and knocked out that 70 cents, which puts Matt in San Francisco in a bind, who said, put me down for $18.70. That seems to be where Trump wants to take us back to. Well, yeah, our 1870 BC, if it can't be argued that people were more civilized then than they were. But, yeah, I get the point, Matt. Thank you. Problem is, that took us down to 298 even. So now with what Matt does, that'll take us down to 279.30. But thank you, Matt, so very much. 279.30, it'll be 479.30 for the plate passing. And you know, when it gets up that high, we either have to turn on the reverb or lock the cathedral doors. The cleaning bill was outrageous for that last time. I never heard the end of it from Brother Deacon Gerald of the Building and Grounds Committee. That's where, 279.30, 479.30, and God knows if we were going to come up with the this week to cover next week. Oh, Jesus, that would be 1279.30, but I won't even talk about that. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to all of you who helped keep the program going. Thanks to everybody in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox, Ben Birch. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch on Facebook, and at Coal River MTN on Twitter. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.